A year ago today at President Biden's inauguration, he vowed that Washington would again lead the world in diplomacy. 1 year in, how's he doing?
The jury is out in terms of whether or not this shift will have been a success.
Also ahead, European nations are debating how to vaccinate their people. In Austria, a mandatory jab is now in place. In the Netherlands, they've set up a vaccine hesitation hotline.
It is really, really successful, and about 50% of the people that are on the phone say that they will get their vaccination.
And in the Pacific Northwest, Canadians are upset that fishermen in Alaska are catching too much of their salmon.
And so our fishermen are sitting on the beach, unable to fish, partly because what might be available to catch is being harvested in Alaska.
I'm Marco Werman. That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. Near the border of Ukraine, the situation remains the same. Tens of thousands of Russian troops in position. The big question, is another Russian invasion about to take place? Clearly, this is on President Biden's mind. During his two-hour news conference yesterday, the president was asked if he thinks Russian President Vladimir Putin is planning military action.
I'm not so sure he has certain what he's going to do. My guess is he will move in. He has to do something.
Do something, but what exactly? The World's Daniel Offman has been closely following the story and joins me to discuss. So, Daniel, if President Biden thinks the Russians are planning to invade, where does that leave the U.S. right now?
The U.S. is trying to keep the conversation going with Russia. It still wants to find a diplomatic solution. I mean, there were talks all of last week between the U.S. and Russia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with Ukraine's president yesterday in Kyiv, and tomorrow Blinken will meet with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. But in all of these communications, the U.S. is making clear that if Russia were to invade Ukraine again, it would face real repercussions, and that would mean more sanctions.
You've been reaching out to people in Ukraine. What are they telling you about how the situation feels there?
Well, I think there are some mixed feelings across the board in Ukraine. I spoke today with an analyst with the Atlantic Council, Vladislav Davidson. He's in Odessa in southern Ukraine. Here's what he said.
There's a lot of anxiety and a lot of cognitive dissonance in terms of people ignoring the obvious. The population has kind of become inured to living with the bomb, so to speak.
Of course, this conflict has been ongoing since 2014, so people have been living with this confrontation with Russia for a while. But Davidson told me that walking through the streets of Kyiv yesterday, he saw something else.
I saw plaques for newly minted self-defense organizations that I didn't see on those streets last time I walked through them.
So there's the sense that people in Ukraine are prepared to defend their country should Russia invade Ukraine yet again.
I mean, it's not always easy to interpret the signals from the Kremlin, but what are Russian authorities saying?
Russian authorities are doubling down, sticking to their guns, so to speak, on their position. Russian authorities say that it's their right to deploy troops on their territory. It has told the U.S. and NATO that it wants legal guarantees that Ukraine won't join the military alliance. Of course, that's a red line that the U.S. has said that it won't cross. But Russian authorities are not budging from that position.
So the big question on many people's minds now is how likely is it that we're heading toward more war in Ukraine?
As I said earlier, of course, there already is an ongoing war in eastern Ukraine that started in 2014 after Russia annexed Crimea and began a war in eastern Ukraine. Now, often people see the situation in terms of war or no war, but there's another possibility that Russia would like to start a quick destabilizing operation in Ukraine. I spoke with a military analyst, Mikhail Osamas. He follows this stuff closely over at the New Geopolitics Research Network in Kyiv. Here's what he told me.
Russia is absolutely capable to do any military operations, to move several thousand troops for several thousand kilometers for a couple hours.
As he said, Russia has proven that it could move those kind of forces very quickly. Now, some analysts are still saying that Russia is amassing troops as a sort of negotiation tactic, using military pressure to force the U.S.'s hand or NATO's hand. But as more time has passed and diplomatic efforts have gone nowhere, many have become more worried about a direct military confrontation.
So finally, Daniel, I'm wondering what Russians and Ukrainians who are not in decision-making positions, what do they make of this geopolitical brinksmanship?
Well, according to surveys, both on the Ukrainian and on the Russian side, Russians and Ukrainians don't want to go to war. Of course, war for regular people in Ukraine, for example, is not theoretical. As I said, they've been at war since 2014, and it's not welcomed on the Russian or on the Ukrainian side. Here's military analyst Mikhail Osamas again.
It will be a massive tragedy, not only for Ukraine and Europe, but for Russia as well, because it could be full-scale war in Europe and Russia.
And that means displacement, death, injury, an overall crisis that would have ripple effects throughout Europe, and that's a reality no one wants to see.
The World's Daniel Hoffman speaking with me about the ongoing tension between Russia and Ukraine. Daniel, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
We'll take a look at President Biden's overall foreign policy during his first year in office. That's later this hour. The refugee camp around Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, the largest in the world, keeps catching on fire. It's happened four times this year, with huge blazes breaking out in the sprawling camps for Rohingya Muslims. The army in neighboring Myanmar forced out roughly 1 million Rohingya people from their homeland in Myanmar. With fires now threatening this already troubled population, there could be a way to improve the situation. But as the world's Patrick Wynn reports, politics are the problem.
There's no other word for it but inferno. That crackling sound? Those are homes turning to cinder and ash. The scene was captured on Tuesday by Mohammed Zonaid, a Rohingya refugee, posting on Twitter. So far this year, these camps near the city of Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh, they have seen a huge fire on average every 5 days. Thousands of homes are just gone. Imrul Islam is with the Norwegian Refugee Council, and he's based in the Bangladesh capital, Dhaka.
Each time, flames have left a trail of devastation and dread. They've ripped through flimsy shelters and left refugees with nothing.
He's seen the aftermath himself, and he says one of the first things you notice is the smell.
I mean, it stings your nostrils, right? Because the shelters are made of bamboo and tarp, and when that burns, it's a very strong stench of burnt plastic.
As to why these fires keep happening, that's no mystery. These camps are very crowded, an endless sea of flimsy huts, spaced just a couple of feet apart. The roof on these shelters is often just a plastic tarp, held in place by tree branches. And Imrul Islam says the structure itself is usually wooden or bamboo.
This means that refugees are effectively living in matchboxes.
Why not give them homes made of stuff that isn't cheap plastic and kindling? Well, this is a problem in refugee camps all over the world. The host government always says, no, no, refugees are only guests, no permanent housing.
Everything has to be temporary. You can't really come in and build a concrete structure. You can't use cement, you can't use bricks for homes. Even the size of the shelter, it's mandated by authorities.
Imrul Islam says the key word is temporary. Tents, huts, the sort of shelter you could knock down with a hard kick. For decades, the Rohingya people have suffered a genocidal campaign in their homeland along the coast of Myanmar. Myanmar's military intensified its purge in 2017, and that's when most of them fled into Bangladesh. Then last year, Myanmar's army seized total power over the country, which has led to more uprisings and rebellion. Long story short, it will not be stable enough for the Rohingya to go home anytime soon.
I mean, the prospects for safe and durable return, it's very slim right now.
So Imrul Islam says the least the world could do for the Rohingya is give them homes that won't catch fire.
Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh are survivors of grievous atrocities, atrocities that we can't even imagine.
Now, the government of Bangladesh does have a second site for Rohingya refugees on a remote island, and its shelters are made of brick so they don't get blown away by monsoons. That island accommodates maybe 10% of the nearly 1 million refugees living in the country. Most will remain in the mainland camps. Imrul Islam says families living there don't wonder if they'll face another fire. It's just a matter of when.
And the uncertainty and fear, it's pervasive. Refugees are anxious and tired. And the parents I spoke to told me that they're actually scared to go to sleep because they don't know when the next fire will occur.
For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
For more than a month, students and professors at a prestigious public university in Mexico City have been protesting what they say is inappropriate government interference into scientific research. They say the new director at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics was put in place improperly. As the world's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia reports from Mexico City, the situation has become the latest battleground in Mexico over academic freedom.
The protest chants at the university included this one: more science, less obedience. It's more lyrical in Spanish because it rhymes. Students held up signs and slept in tents at the research institute known as CIDE, for its acronym in Spanish, for a total of 48 days. If you ask the students why they did it, the response has a lot to do with school loyalty.
Well, I think that the answer is, of course, because I love CIDE.
Jimena Millán Cruz is a 21-year-old student.
I'm studying political science and international relations.
Millán Cruz says she first heard of the CIDE through a summer school program for high school students interested in public policy. She says when she arrived to campus and met other teenagers who were also interested in public service, she knew she had found her place.
For me, it was really special to know that there were a lot of people, like 17-year-olds, that were thinking the same way that I was, and that I wasn't so weird. So when I entered CIDE, I felt that I belonged.
The CIDE is a small and proud community of roughly 400 undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral students. And Millán Cruz says many of them became concerned when President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's administration eliminated public trust funds that paid for research at the center. But students became alarmed last semester when the government agency that oversees the CIDE broke several rules in the process of naming a new director. Millán Cruz says the first video conference between interim director José Antonio Romero Tellaeche and students did not go well.
In the meeting, he said that we were ideological sponges and that we were literally sponges. So we were like, okay, that's one way to see the problem.
According to several students on the call, Romero Tellaeche echoed several opinions by the Mexican president disparaging the institute. The students recalled that Romero Tellaeche said the CIDE was an incubator for neoliberal thought and that it should be at the service of the administration's agenda. Romero Tellaeche has since fired a number of top administrators who disagreed with him. Sandra Ley, a political science professor, says this concerns not only students, but also faculty.
Of course, yeah, that's a bigger issue. I'd like to be part of this agenda, maybe, but I'd like to be part of this agenda as long as I can be objective. As long as if I find that there have been mistakes that have been done, I'm going to say it.
The concerns have extended beyond Mexico's borders. Hundreds of university professors from across Latin America, the United States, and Europe, including two Nobel laureates, have called on the Mexican government to guarantee the academic integrity of the CIDE. Susan Parker is a former professor at CIDE who now teaches public policy at the University of Maryland.
Okay, well, I've signed several different letters.
Parker says what the administration of López Obrador is doing with the research institute is in line with the disqualification of scientific experts in the U.S. and elsewhere. López Obrador is also known by his initials, AMLO.
Part of it is what you see in other areas of the world, too. No tolerance for any kind of criticism. And yeah, that's what academics do. We're critical. You know, we criticize bad policies. And so that's, you know, just sort of unforgivable for AMLO, I would say.
The government agency that oversees the CIDE postponed a hearing to name the institute's interim director permanently. Students say they will continue their protest. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
A massive offshore ecological preserve in Ecuador, plus a fish fight between Canada and Alaska. Those stories are just ahead. You're listening to The World.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. A large swath of the Pacific Ocean will now be off limits to destructive fishing practices. The area is northwest of the world-famous Galapagos Islands. The government of Ecuador created the new marine reserve to try and save marine species from human pressure. Luis Suarez is with the organization Conservation International Ecuador. He's part of a large coalition that has worked to get this protected area established. He joins us from Quito, the capital. Why is this protected area so important, Luis? What kind of species do you hope will benefit from it?
The new marine reserve is very important because it protects between the Galapagos Islands and Costa Rica, creating a very important migratory way for whales, for sharks, for sea turtles, and also for manta rays. It's very important in protecting ecosystems, but also in helping species to migrate in a safe way.
I mean, it does seem like a significant step. I think back to just 2020, and you raised the alarm about huge Chinese fishing fleets, more than 300 boats that were parked near the Galapagos Island, right outside of existing marine reserves, waiting for various fishes to swim out of their protected area. I mean, you wrote about how more protection was needed near the islands. Do you think this expanded area will be enough?
This has been a long negotiation among different actors, between the government, the fishing sector, as well as the tourism sector, and the scientific community. So the current area is very important. However, we would like to see in the near future even a larger area protected.
So keep growing the area of protection. Ecuador already has some marine reserves, and despite these protections, illegal fishing persists. Are we talking then about greater enforcement and fines? And if so, how do you get there?
Yeah, one of the advantages of creating marine protected areas is it increases control and surveillance. Once you have a marine protected area, you can disincentivize the illegal fishing in a region. You increase the presence of control boats. You increase also monitoring using satellite technology. And in that way, you send a message to the illegal fishers that these areas have presence of conservation organizations, and especially the presence of the Galapagos National Park Service. So for us, protected areas is one of the most important strategies to improve ocean conservation in the world.
And Ecuador is cooperating with Colombia and Costa Rica and Panama to link their marine reserves. How could a partnership like that help strengthen enforcement of conservation laws?
Yeah, in 2004, the four countries joined and made a joint declaration to create the Eastern Tropical Pacific Marine Corridor. It's a very interesting proposal of the four countries joining efforts to do conservation in their own territories, but at the same time increasing cooperation and collaboration. This region has several species that are shared among the four countries. So in order to protect these species, you really need to do conservation at the regional scale. That increases also the control and surveillance. It increases also potential for tourism because some of the most important diving sites in this region are located in Galapagos, in Cocos Island in Costa Rica, and in Malpelo in Colombia. So here we have a fantastic place for diving and also for commercial species. Remember that tuna fish is highly migratory also, and we have three species of tuna migrating among these protected areas and also the coastlines of these four countries, Costa Rica, Panama, Colombia, and Ecuador.
Luis, you are invested in the health of the Galapagos Islands and the surrounding waters. What do these new protections mean to you personally?
Yeah, I have been in Galapagos since I was 19 years old. I used to work in the 80s as a naturalist guide, and now I'm working in conservation for the last 31 years, very involved in the environmental movement in Ecuador. Galapagos is a World Heritage Site, is a fantastic area in terms of the species that are only found in the Galapagos archipelago. Galapagos is a laboratory of evolution, but also a laboratory of sustainable development. We are learning here how to conserve biodiversity and at the same time improving the living conditions for human populations. Galapagos is so important not only for Ecuador, for the region, but for the whole planet.
Luis Suarez is Vice President of Conservation International Ecuador, speaking with us from the capital, Quito. It was great to have you with us to talk about this. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
Up in Alaska, salmon fishing is a tightly regulated industry that's crucial to the economy there. Still, there are some Alaskan fishing practices that rankle Canadians. A new report says that commercial fishermen in southeast Alaska are catching a disproportionate number of endangered Canadian salmon. Critics say it's time to renegotiate the treaty that governs salmon fishing in the entire region. Reporter Anita Elash has that story.
Chief Joe Alphonse says the annual sockeye salmon run is a crucial part of life for members of the Chilcotin First Nation in northern British Columbia.
That's part of our diet, that's part of our way of life, is that sockeye salmon.
The annual run is when the salmon return from their breeding grounds and when they're typically fished. But the number of salmon in BC's rivers has plummeted. Last year, it was at an all-time low. Alphonse says he's outraged to learn that Alaskan fishermen might be contributing to the problem.
The fishing is unacceptable. It's irresponsible. And it just blows me away when they want to catch every last fish for profit.
Many of BC's largest salmon runs pass by the Alaska Panhandle before heading back home to spawn. Fishermen can tell Canadian and American salmon apart because they're genetically distinct. While the Canadian fish are in Alaskan waters, they get mixed up with Alaskan salmon, and some end up on Alaskan fishing boats. The new report from two Canadian salmon conservation groups found that last year, three-quarters of the Alaskan catch of endangered sockeye salmon should have ended up back in BC. Greg Taylor wrote the report.
With the declining abundance and productivity of British Columbia salmon populations, the impact upon British Columbia stocks from the Alaskan fisheries is increasing and looks like it will keep on increasing into the future if something isn't done to curtail the Alaskan fishery.
That's especially hard to swallow, Taylor says, because most of the salmon fisheries in BC were closed last year because there were no salmon.
Our fishermen are sitting on the beach, unable to fish, partly because what might be available to catch is being harvested in Alaska.
Danny Everson is a fisheries scientist with Alaska's Department of Fish and Game.
You know, we take sustainability of our fisheries very seriously.
The Pacific Salmon Treaty between Canada and the United States covers this type of fishing. Everson says Alaskan fishermen never take more Canadian fish than the treaty allows.
It doesn't serve us well to drive some other stock into the toilet, you know, because we want the fisheries to be sustainable because we want to continue to have harvest opportunities.
Taylor says Alaskan fishermen could solve the problem by moving to waters where there are fewer Canadian fish. He hopes his report might pressure them into making those kinds of changes. Chief Joe Alphonse said it's time to review the Pacific Salmon Treaty to make sure both Canada and the United States are preventing overfishing. For The World, Anita Elash, Toronto.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. More tension in East Jerusalem as a Palestinian family is evicted from their home. Washington could step in, but some argue that American leaders don't think it's worth the trouble.
It's just not seen as important enough for any administration to put up with the kind of resistance that they're going to have both from the Israelis and from supporters of Israel in the United States.
The flashpoint that is the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In his inaugural address a year ago today, President Biden made a vow that diplomacy would be back and that American leadership would be front and center on the world stage.
America has been tested, and we've come out stronger for it. We will repair our alliances and engage with the world once again.
But 1 year later, what has the Biden administration accomplished on that front? Suzanne Maloney is here to help us consider that question. She's the vice president and director of the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution. When you look at what President Biden and his team were up against this past year, Suzanne, in a very tumultuous world, did they rise to the occasion with a creative, effective approach to foreign policy?
They faced an unprecedented set of challenges. Let's be clear about what they were actually up against. A global pandemic and all the social and economic disruption that came with it. an acute democratic crisis that builds upon years of polarization and a considerable amount of institutional damage from the 4 years of a very disruptive Trump administration. And what we saw is that the administration came in, I think, with a clear set of priorities, a really terrific, experienced team, and set about trying to shift U.S. foreign policy to deal with the most significant challenge of our lifetime, and that is the strategic competition with the great powers like China and Russia. But it is a very complex environment, and they have faced several areas where they have stumbled. And I think that the jury is out in terms of whether or not this shift will have been a success.
Well, as you just said, I mean, President Biden's biggest strategic foreign policy challenges are China and Russia. But analysts would point to Afghanistan as a place where his plans really went off the rails last August. In his press conference yesterday, he nodded to that.
There's no way to get out of Afghanistan after 20 years. Easily. Not possible, no matter when you did it.
Biden did get U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, Suzanne, but he paid a huge price. Will history be kind to him about this withdrawal?
I think the mechanics of the withdrawal were lacking in terms of appreciating how quickly the Afghan government would fall and how chaotic the circumstances would be on the ground, and really what the longstanding after effects are going to be of the vacuum that has been created for terrorist groups to occupy in Afghanistan today. What they have yet to fully grapple with is the underlying message to the international community, specifically from our adversaries around the world who read this as not a pragmatic decision by an administration that was really seeking to train its resources on the most important strategic challenges, but rather as an admission of weakness and incompetence by a fading superpower. And I think that is the narrative that is playing out in places like Beijing and Moscow and Tehran and other parts of the world.
Same kind of thing when it comes to Ukraine. Biden seems focused on keeping U.S. troops out of harm's way. If Russia invades Ukraine, Biden does not have a lot of options, but he didn't exactly admit that in yesterday's press conference. Let's hear this.
It's one thing if it's a minor incursion, and then we end up having a fight about what to do and not do, etc. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia if they further invade Ukraine.
So now President Biden is differentiating between minor and major incursions. Has the Kremlin effectively boxed Biden in when it comes to Ukraine?
The administration is walking a very fine line between essentially falling into a trap set by Putin in terms of overcommitting American credibility and prestige and presence, but also ensuring that the Russians have some opportunity to pull back from the brink. You know, this is an administration that recognizes there's really no appetite among the American public for a new front, a new Cold War. But the levers that we have to dissuade someone as determined and calculating as Vladimir Putin are relatively limited.
So I want to pick up on something you said earlier, Suzanne, institutional damage from Biden's predecessor. I know there was relief in some parts of the world when Biden came in last year, but how long lasting is that halo? Does Biden still have some convincing to do?
Well, I think the United States is not just suffering from the after effects of the Trump administration, but really from the roots of what produced this disruptive time in American politics. All the problems of inequity and disinformation that have enabled our democratic crisis to not just persist even after the change in administrations, but in some ways become even more intractable. And that poses a challenge for Biden on the world stage, because both our friends and our enemies are watching to see how long this administration will last, what may come after it, and whether America can, in fact, remain the most significant force on the international stage.
So it's probably too early in the president's term to see a sort of Biden doctrine emerging. But what do you see as the guiding principles behind this administration's foreign policy when you're in?
I think the president has really leaned into the values question, that, you know, we have common values that we want to ensure both at home and abroad, and that we work with those who share those same values to try to strengthen them and to expand the space and room for maneuver around the world. He undertook this summit for democracy virtually back in December, and I think this is an area where he does seek to try to make his legacy. The reality, though, is that hard power politics require compromise, require the ability to move tactically, and require engagement even with unsavory actors. And so, you know, I think that one of the dangers of relying too heavily on the value proposition is simply that the president can be accused of hypocrisy when it comes to supporting additional arms sales to Saudi Arabia or other types of steps that aren't entirely consistent with that rhetoric or agenda.
Suzanne Maloney is the vice president and director of the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution, speaking with us about President Biden's foreign policy 1 year on. Suzanne, really appreciate your time on this. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Compulsory COVID vaccines for everyone. For some people, it makes perfect sense. For others, it's unthinkable. In Austria today, Parliament voted in favor of making the COVID vaccine a requirement for all adults. It is the first European country to do so. But as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, expectations that the rest of the EU will follow suit are very much in doubt.
Protests against mandatory vaccines are now a weekly event in Vienna. Thousands marched through the Austrian capital last Saturday, chanting the government must go. The mandate comes into effect on the 1st of February. And earlier this week, Austria's government explained its approach.
Also, Anfang Februar tritt sie in Kraft. Es wird eine Eingangsphase geben.
Chancellor Karl Nehammer said the mandate will be introduced gradually. Authorities will now write to every household to inform them of the plan, and people have until mid-March to get vaccinated. In Germany, new Chancellor Olaf Scholz appears to be stepping back from his promise to make vaccines compulsory this spring. Scholz's coalition partner, the Free Democrats, have proposed a compromise, recommending that only those over 50 be required to get the jab. German lawmaker Andrew Ullmann tells me he's already come under fire for the proposal he helped to write.
I have plenty of voters who are disappointed. I don't even know if they're really voters or not, because when you check or Google them, they do not live in my constituency. But I also received a death threat by email as well, and this is being followed by the police.
Ullmann is also proposing that all unvaccinated people must attend an information session about the benefits of the vaccine before any fines are introduced. Earlier this week, thousands marched through cities across Germany against a possible mandate and other COVID restrictions. Ullmann spoke to some of the protesters marching in his home city of Würzburg.
I talked with demonstrators at this rally because they recognized me as one of the MPs, and they were pretty much reasonable, and they actually appreciated the idea of a professional mandatory consultation for those who are not vaccinated, because they're not always right-wing extremists. There are also people there that have concerns that have to be taken seriously.
In the Netherlands, doctors and medical students have set up the Twijfel telephone.
Welcome to the vaccinatie-twijfel telephone.
It's essentially a vaccination hesitation hotline. Julia van Veert, who's a professor of health communications at University of Amsterdam, says the line gets around 1,000 calls a day.
It is really, really successful, and about 50% of the people that are on the phone say at the end of the telephone call that they will get their vaccination, and the other 50% doesn't say anything, but still part of them will also get the vaccination probably.
Van Veert says trying to force people to get the jab could backfire and fuel more protests. Many unvaccinated people just need better information, she says.
These talks are very often in the mainstream media. Not everybody is following the mainstream media. And many people, especially those in the lower economic environments, and also, for instance, the migrant people, they are not reached.
Van Veert says the Dutch government is unlikely to make the vaccine compulsory. But in Greece and in Italy, authorities have already introduced partial mandates. Anyone over 60 in Greece could now be fined $114 a month if they don't get vaccinated, while in Italy, people over 50 will have to show proof of the vaccine or immunity just to go to work. Italian virologist Dr. Roberto Burioni says most Italians approve of the new measures because they remember just how badly the country suffered at the start of the pandemic.
The period of the spring 2020 was really terrible, at least here in Lombardia, the part of Italy where I'm working. It was really a catastrophic event, and nobody is forgetting that. So I think that we have learned the hard way how bad this virus could be.
Burioni says the mandate might not ease everyone's fears about the vaccine, but it will have an impact.
Well, I don't think it will change their mind. I think it will force them to be vaccinated because, you know, if you lose your job, if you are suspended from work, if you are afraid of the vaccine for irrational reasons, probably you overcome the fear that is taking you away from vaccination.
Several European governments are still deciding whether to make vaccines compulsory, but some, like the UK's health minister, Sajid Javid, says it's just not going to happen.
Taking a vaccine should be a positive choice. In terms of requiring mandatory vaccination for the general population, I don't think that's something we would ever look at.
Most European countries do have COVID passports in place already. So if you're unvaccinated, going to a coffee shop or a restaurant is going to be a whole lot harder. And even if vaccines are not made compulsory, street protests across Europe against COVID restrictions look set to continue. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Earlier this week, a Palestinian family was evicted from their home in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem. An Israeli court sided with a Jerusalem municipality over the rights to the land. The case has put the spotlight back on this flashpoint neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. East Jerusalem generally has been a ground where Palestinians and Israelis have struggled. It's become especially volatile over the past year. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Rashid Khalidi. He's the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. Rashid, what's your reaction to the eviction of this Palestinian family, and how do you think this is going to affect the situation on the ground right now?
Well, I certainly can't predict what might happen, but the last major attempted eviction in Sheikh Jarrah led to a massive reaction all over Palestine, in Jerusalem, and later spreading to the West Bank, Gaza, Palestinians inside Israel. And this is a flashpoint, and this is an issue that is very sensitive for Palestinians because it brings up a process of ethnic cleansing, which has been going on for 70-odd years, where Jewish populations are implanted in place of Palestinian populations, where property is taken over under a variety of pretexts, sometimes semi-legal or legalized after the fact, and sometimes simply brute force. We're going to take it because we're stronger.
Ethnic cleansing often tends to evoke images of mass graves, but this is how Palestinians see it in East Jerusalem?
Absolutely. People are not being killed here, obviously. This is not a policy of extermination. It's a policy of expulsion and seizure of property, creeping annexation, gradual usurpation of rights and property and space by a settler colonial project that has always aimed to turn Palestine into the land of Israel.
Would you say that among Palestinians in East Jerusalem that there is a general fear of expulsion?
Yes, I think that what they're afraid of is replacement. The idea is to turn Jerusalem, the occupied Arab parts of East Jerusalem that were taken over by Israel in 1967, into majority Jewish areas by restricting the Palestinians from building and from expanding and from implanting in seized and stolen and otherwise acquired land, increasing the Jewish population. I would remind listeners that that is what happened in large parts of West Jerusalem in 1948. 30,000 Palestinian Arabs were driven from their homes in the fighting in the spring of 1948 in neighborhoods in West Jerusalem that are now some of the most chic neighborhoods of the Israeli capital.
Rashid, how did East Jerusalem become so contested?
Well, I mean, Jerusalem is symbolically important for everybody, for both of these two peoples, the Palestinians and the Israelis. Jerusalem is seen as symbolic in national terms. And so Israel insists it's the indivisible, eternal capital of Israel, and the Palestinians say it's our capital as well, together with the religious factors, make it extraordinarily contested place.
Mm. And today we have many Palestinians who see Sheikh Jarrah as a microcosm of the wider conflict, especially around land rights. And Israelis, on the other hand, say this is simply a real estate issue that's been blown out of proportion. Would you say the framing here is what makes a difference, really, in how both sides understand what's going on?
I think it's partly an issue of framing, and it's partly an issue of deception and deceit. To call it a real estate issue is monumental deceit. It's not a real estate issue. This is not a question of, you know, my property on East 72nd Street in New York City. Do I have a right to it or not? This is a national issue. This is a political issue. This is a part of a process that has been ongoing since the settler colonial project of Zionism was established.
So with Palestinians continuing to claim East Jerusalem as a capital of a future state and Israel continuing to claim all of Jerusalem as its undivided capital, I mean, how do you square that circle? How do you go about resolving that?
Well, I think the only way to do it on a basis that's just is to say that everybody has to have equal rights. Everybody has to have equal national rights, and that means equal rights to property. That means equal rights in terms of human rights and civil rights and political rights. It means that one group or one individual's rights cannot be exercised at the expense of another. To say, only I have the right to worship here, or to say, only I have rights to this property because my legal system privileges me, is not a way in which this can be solved. On the contrary, that's why we have a problem.
Rashid Khalidi is a Palestinian-American historian and the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University. He's also the author of The 100 Years' War on Palestine. Rashid, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Ghana is facing vaccine hesitancy, even though some 17 million vaccine doses have been available there since last March. Now the country is looking for creative ways to get people vaccinated, like at the beach and in nightclubs. Reporter Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra told us all about it. Check out the photos from his reporting on our website, theworld.org. Keeping up with the latest on the pandemic is confusing. What with quickly changing policies and the breakneck speed of scientific research, it's left many of us scrambling to know what to do. That's especially true for pregnant women who are deciding whether to get vaccinated. Their vaccination rates are much lower. But as the world's Ilana Gordon reports, increasing research in the UK and beyond is finding it's important to get vaccinated during pregnancy.
Marika Peters was so excited to realize she was pregnant last year. But then things got stressful. Should she get a vaccine against COVID-19?
I mean, your instinct is like, I don't want to take anything that I'm not 100% certain is going to be fine. Nobody is 100% certain about this.
And that was especially true early on in the vaccine rollout. Peters works on a science program at the BBC. She is surrounded by researchers. But everything felt uncertain, including the recommendations. Pregnant people were not included in vaccine clinical trials. Peters already had two miscarriages pre-COVID.
It's really, really hard. My big thing was, what if I have a third miscarriage and I obviously won't know what's caused it, but I'll always wonder if it was the vaccine. So that kind of made me more wary.
So here she was, navigating a web of confusion and stress about the vaccines. But the danger of COVID-19 to pregnant people was becoming clearer.
As a doctor, having to count women who are coming to harm is such a depressing thing. I mean, it's heart-wrenching.
Dr. Aris Papageorgiou is a professor of maternal and fetal medicine at the University of Oxford. He's also a clinician at St. George's Hospital in London. He saw COVID causing a rapid decline in pregnant people. Fever spikes, move to respiratory problems.
You know, we've seen women who've had to be admitted to intensive care where the baby needed to be delivered. It's super sad. You know, a husband can't visit his wife. It's prohibited. The baby's born early, the woman's intubated. Tragic, really.
Papageorgiou's own research has looked at the risks of COVID-19 to expecting parents around the world in more than a dozen countries.
Women were much more likely to have premature birth, much more likely to get preeclampsia, more likely to have maternal morbidity, mortality, if you sort of counted it all together. They were, you know, 20 times more likely to die, you know, much more likely to go to intensive care.
As information was emerging about the dangers of getting COVID-19 while pregnant, real-world data was coming in of tens of thousands of people who got vaccinated while pregnant. It gave assurances about the vaccine itself in terms of safety. For Dr. Sarah Stock, a researcher at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, this sends a very clear message.
Vaccination is the safest and most effective way for pregnant women to protect themselves and their unborn babies.
Stocks recently published research in Scotland of the impacts of COVID-19 on pregnant people. She also documented that those who wound up in critical care were overwhelmingly unvaccinated. But this information has been slow to translate. About 2/3 of pregnant people are not vaccinated in the UK.
It worries me that vaccine uptake is lower in pregnant populations than in general populations. And particularly that we saw such low rates in the youngest and most deprived populations.
Research has also found that vaccination can benefit the developing fetus. The antibodies get passed on. The World Health Organization now recommends people who are pregnant be prioritized for vaccination. Last summer, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control updated its recommendations. In mid-December, the U.K.'s advisory group added those who are pregnant to the vaccination priority list. Elizabeth Duff is with the National Childbirth Trust in the U.K.
We were pleased to see it.
She says it's hard when so much misinformation and mixed messaging is already out there. She hopes this clarity will ease the confusion and anxiety that many expecting parents face with this decision.
We felt that they needed to be given some extra understanding of why they should have it. It emphasizes the fact that it's safe. It's given the maternity services some help to be able to offer that service within antenatal clinics.
As for Marika Peters, she says her pregnancy journey and vaccine decisions have been a roller coaster. But with strong backing from her partner, she decided to get it.
The big push for me was the message came out that COVID in the third trimester for an unvaccinated pregnant woman was very serious.
She is feeling good about the decision. She got a booster too. But she is so ready for this all to be over.
I just want to give birth and then I won't be worried about catching COVID anymore.
She's due the 1st of March. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Finally today, let's meet one of the breakout artists in the UK from the past year. This is Joy Crooks from a few years ago. She wrote the song Poison when she was 16.
You're scared of snakes. I'm scared of you, but you've got poison.
It went viral on YouTube. 7 years later, in 2021, it showed up again on Joy's debut album, Skin.
The poison, you say you got it from your mother. The poison.
Joy Crooks is a Londoner at heart. Born there to a mother from Dhaka, Bangladesh, her father from Dublin. Crooks' lyrics are thoughtful. She credits her favorite class in school, history, for that. And she explained to German entertainment network Diffus a couple of months ago.
The reason why I love history is because you need to know your sources, but also you need to know context. Context is like incredibly important in understanding a piece of history or a story in history, etc. What was going on in that time for this to happen, right? So I see my music in the same way. It's like giving you all of the context before the actual moment of impact.
You say you got it from some others. The poison, there isn't anyone.
Last year wasn't just a boost for Joy Crooks as a British musician. She was also selected to be part of a 50th anniversary celebration of the creation of her mother's home of Bangladesh. That led to this performance broadcast by the BBC. This is Joy's cover of a love song from a 1959 Bengali musical film. The song was a huge hit in Bengali-speaking India and what was then East Pakistan, the area before it became Bangladesh. Airat Tomar Amar is the title, which translates from Bengali as Tonight is Mine and Yours. As one commenter wrote on YouTube, "Proud of you, I am a Bengali." Another wrote, "Beautiful Joy, keep on singing Bangla songs." The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be right back with you here tomorrow.